WLFP Braddock.
Hello, diners and travelers of the world, and good morning, Peter.
Hello, Peter. Yeah, well, I'm not a diner and traveler of the world. I'm excluded from that category.
No, are you?
I wouldn't have thought so.
And we have our guest on the line. Hello, Sue Doody.
Hi, and Peter. Good to be with you.
Yeah, and Sue has written. First of all, Sue started a restaurant that's become an absolute landmark in Columbus called Lindy's, and it's 25 years old now, Sue?
Yes. 26, actually,
26.
This year. It was 25 when the book came out.
And if you really want to know about owning a restaurant, she also wrote this called Biography of a Bistro, As the Tables Turn is the name of the book, and you will learn things that you couldn't even imagine that you need to know or to learn to run a restaurant. Sue, a fascinating book. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks. It was great fun. It took us a year and a half to write it, and, of course, it took 25 years to put it all together. So it was great. I knew from early in the beginning of the restaurant that I really wanted to document some of these interesting, sometimes funny things that happened in the restaurant business. But I was just a homemaker, mother of four, and divorced, and I had done catering and also gave some gourmet cooking lessons, and all of a sudden found myself in the restaurant business.
And how did you have time with four children to even think about doing this?
Well, they were getting a little bit older, and I think, you know, I just married the restaurant, actually. I didn't get married again after that one time, and the children, I had four. One was in college and the others were in high school, and then one who was still in middle school. So she was the challenge. I was running back and forth a lot.
Oh, I bet. Now your ex-husband is a designer, was he?
He was. He is a designer, and he also taught marketing at Ohio State. Taught school in Columbus Public Schools before the children were born while he was working on his doctorate at Ohio State.
Uh-huh.
And then he had a design firm, and he actually was instrumental in helping us with the design of the restaurant because we knew that we wanted to have it more like an Upper East Side New York cafe kind of atmosphere, casual but elegant, you know, with wines and the freshest ingredient, everything made from scratch.
And at that time, this was a very unusual idea for Columbus, right?
It was. There wasn't anything like it. I mean, there wasn't anything like it in the sense that there were a couple fine dining places, and then there were a lot of casual dining places, but there was nothing quite like Lindy's, more like a bistro brasserie type thing that you'd find in France, or as I said, the Upper East Side of New York.
And
you know, had a lot of
it's in a historic building.
Right, it was a 100-year-old building.
And that was a
challenge.
It had
four different restaurants in the 10 years before I bought it.
And everybody said this was a terrible place, right?
I beg your pardon?
Everybody predicted this was not going to be a very successful location.
They all said, they sort of referred to me. I live in a section of Columbus called Upper Arlington, and they said, Upper Arlington den mother thinks she can make a go of this white elephant in German Village. So that was printed in the Dispatch, the Columbus Dispatch.
They were
forecasting a great success.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Now, I mean, in this book, it becomes very clear that you have a whole crew surrounding you, both employees and customers, that are really characters in their own right, right?
Right. There's quite a few characters along with regular customers that are some, you know, kind of the movers and shakers of Columbus, and of course being the capital, you know, we have the legislature here, so we, you know, have a lot of politicians coming in, and there's a lot of deals. I know that we had one night, we had both parties for the Republican contingency as well as the Democrats upstairs, and my banquet coordinator decided he better call and tell them, and sure enough, one canceled.
Oh, really? Yeah. Okay.
So it must have been a political type get-together. They were really worried about the other party being in the next room.
You know, there are so many stories to tell. Now, was this, I was looking at this thing with the man who can tie a maraschino cherry stem with his tongue.
Right.
I mean, was that a real thing or what?
I guess that people have known about that before the book came out, and they said, oh, that they loved that whole thing because they remember when that was sort of a popular thing in the 70s or something to do. And I had never heard of it myself, but Michael remembered it. So Michael was the one who included that. And then there's lots of stories of some of the mishaps of the waiters. And we don't have an elevator. We do have a second floor, but we don't have an elevator. But we have a dumb waiter.
Oh, I remember that. Go ahead.
Right. So there have been lots of stories about the dumb waiter and various waiters trying to use it as their means of getting to the second floor, as well as one got his arm caught in it, and that was frightening.
Geez.
For fear that he would lose his arm, but fortunately
nice.
We got it dislodged.
And tell us the story about, tell us how this came about to have your tables and who was sitting at the different tables illustrated.
We have a lot of guests who come in that have their regular table, and they're very indignant, and some have even walked out if there's someone else sitting at their table. So they kind of, you know, have a real feel for wanting to be in a certain place. And, you know, I was amazed when I first opened and found that these people would call up, make their reservation by the table number, because they're all numbered and not visually numbered that you can see, but they found out which table number it was, and then they have designated that their table.
Oh.
So, and then we've had a lot of celebrities coming in, and it's been fun to have those celebrities in. And
everybody. I mean, I just read this list of all the people who've been in there. It's amazing.
Yeah. They've come to Columbus at various times, and so we sort of had the idea of placing them at the tables together, just in the book, that is.
Right.
You know, they're just seated in the book. So you've got Nick Nolte and Judd Hirsch sitting with Jonathan Winters, which would be humorous, and Kay Ballard.
Kay Ballard, too. That's funny.
Yeah.
So, but I think people will enjoy just reading the list of all these celebrities. I guess it's the place to go in Columbus, right?
Well, it has been, you know, and it, you know, it's been, the city's been good to me. I mean, because we have had good success, and then my sons have gone on to build their restaurant.
Yeah, tell us what.
They opened the first Bravo restaurant in Columbus 15 years ago, and now they have 70 restaurants around the country. And, of course, you have five in Pittsburgh area there.
Oh, everybody, you know, when I had my Blue Ribbon Restaurant Committee, everybody, we didn't do chains, but everybody loved Bravo.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. So.
And then they've gone on and they've put a number of Brios up. So Brio is another popular restaurant that they put the first one in Columbus in Easton, which is an interesting shopping mall.
Tell us the funny story about the valet who didn't tip the president of
I think it was the other way around.
Right.
I mean, I meant that.
Right. The Ohio State president was brought in by one of our regular guests, and the valets had kept his car, the snow cleaned off of it, and kept it warm and everything. And then when the president of the university came out, he didn't give the valet exactly what he thought he had earned by taking such good care of his car. So the valet wrote a letter to the Lantern, which is the Ohio State paper that comes out daily, and said that the president of the university was sort of a cheapskate. And so our guest came in and told the manager that he would definitely have to fire this young man that wrote the letter. And so we did that. And then that Saturday night, with the restaurant full of guests and many cars having been parked, the valets hid the keys in one of the trunks of the car and didn't tell us which car, and then left. So we had the locksmith and the taxi cabs, and it was quite a disastrous night.
What do you think was the strangest thing that ever happened to you in your restaurant life?
strangest thing.
We're not going to count the...
Well, I think the people who come in, and there's a whole article about it, and, I mean, a whole little blurb about it. It's not the kind of book that you really want to read through, but you pick it up, and it's really humorous to just read some of the little anecdotes. But the one guest who came in, and the hostess, she said to the hostess that she had a table 4, and she'd like a table, and the hostess informed her it would be about a 2-hour wait, and the woman said, kept saying, "Do you know who I am?" And finally, the hostess turned around and said, "Does anyone know who this woman is? She seems to have forgotten her name." So I don't know. It's just
it's
funny
amazing
things, and there's little quirks from some of the celebrities have come in too, and their dietary things and. So
yeah, how about all those people who came in to get a reservation by claiming that you were best friends with you and you never heard of them and they pronounced your name wrong?
Exactly. Right. We had a whole section there of how they pronounced the name. And also they would say they were a good friend of one of my children and have the entire wrong name for the children.
People are amazing.
So people are amazing. That's true. But it's been great. People have been good to me and it's been fun and... I can't imagine what I would have done with the other 25 years of my life.
Wow. So, but you're still going strong. So,
are you still
involved day to day there?
I am. I'm there during the day. I don't stay as much at night. I used to put in 17-hour days in the beginning, and I actually worked behind the line cooking in the early days.
But then, now
I have really, just accomplished chefs back there, and I think they'd be horrified if I came back and tried to get behind the line with them. But I do still love to cook and take a number of cooking magazines and then Epicurious.com all the time, looking up different recipes and trying things at home. And my children, and I have 8 grandchildren and 4 children and their spouses, and they all know that on Sundays, Grandma cooks.
Oh, that's great. That's
and
wonderful.
And tries different recipes, and they're all welcome to come, but it's not mandatory.
This book does, incidentally, also have recipes in it.
It does. It has 25 recipes of the true blue, tried and true ones that we've had at the restaurant. I said the nut-crusted chicken salad has been a really popular item on our menu, and I know a bunch of ladies told me that they would never come in back in the restaurant again until I put it back on the menu. So it's sort of it's institutionalized now on the menu.
Okay, so once again, now it's Sue Doody's biography of a bistro entitled As the Tables Turn, and the bistro is in German Village in Columbus, Ohio, and everybody's going to want to read this book. Those who are thinking of opening a restaurant or those who are just amused that somebody else had the nerve to do it. So go on www.onthemenuradio.com, OTM bookshelf, click on and buy this book. And
I think it would make a great gift for Christmas, too, for people who are, anybody who's interested in cooking or interested in restauranting.
I think so, too.
Our producer's nodding his head. He agrees with you, Sue.
Oh, good.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate
it.
Okay,
and we'll talk soon.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Take a break.
The internet is crucial to your business. Everybody knows this, but did you know Nidhogg is the company you should call for internet service? Nidhogg, personal web page hosting for less. Business web page hosting, Nidhogg offers both Unix and NT server support. Nidhogg is the company you should call for dedicated internet access. Nidhogg offers DSL for high speed, low cost, always on access. DSL is great. It means no more dial up. Oh, by the way, do you remember that thing called the telephone? Do you remember when people used phone lines to access the internet? Oh, I'm sorry, you still use dial-up? Well, Nidhogg does that too. Local access telephone numbers? Okay, I don't understand it all either, but I do know that I need it, and I know where to get it. Nidhogg, Nidhogg.com, 412-661-5917. That's 661-5917, or log on, Nidhogg.com. Internet the Nidhogg way.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And we have a woman on the line who is one of my heroes, Dorothy Kahn, who is the founder and president of the French Culinary Institute.
Well, she's listing as Dorothy Hamilton. So the
I know. I can't get rid of the Kahn.
Kahn is my maiden name. Hamilton's my married name.
There we go.
It just rolls off my tongue.
Dorothy Hamilton works.
It just rolls off my tongue, Dorothy. Sorry.
Well, you've known me a long time.
Yeah. So we're going to do two different directions here. One is we want to talk about this really wonderful book, Chef's Story. When I got it, I was thinking, I think we already did that with a book that was out recently, but this is just so far superior to that.
That one was called How I Learned to Cook.
Yeah. Now, this is on a different level. This is, first of all, explain to us what this is. It says Companion to the Public Television.
Yeah, well, it's actually a book based on the PBS series that's running right now called Chef's Story. And it's running in 65% of the markets around the United States on the public television station. And the producers from Inside the Actor Studio came to see me years ago and said, we want to do the same kind of show for chefs. And they asked me if I knew somebody who would be a good host. And I gave them a few names, and then I said sheepishly, well, I think I'd be a good host.
That's great.
We did a little treatment, and they liked it, and voila, we got to do the series. And so it's 26 shows where I interview 27 of the top chefs in America. One show has two chefs on it, Dean Faring and Robert Del Grande from Texas, mm-hmm. because they play guitars together, and they're close friends,
That's right.
It was fun to have them on together. So it's 27 chefs and 26 shows, and we explore with them what got them interested in cooking, where their passion comes from, who they are as individuals, what their philosophies are. It's really an insight into their soul.
It's very exciting.
And then there's a very short 5-minute cooking segment where they show you something that they're passionate about right now.
But for those people who can't get PBS, I don't think, for example, this program airs in our home market in Pittsburgh, because I've certainly never seen it. Mm. And for listeners around the world, of course, it's not possible. But it is possible to get this wonderful book, which is a great read. I know, because I read it too.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you.
You know what?
We do have a website called chefstory.com, and it's two S's in the middle, chefs as plural, story. And if you go on there, you can buy the DVDs of the show.
In fact,
we've had cooking schools in Canada call us, and they've bought the DVDs so they can show it to their culinary students.
Oh, that's wonderful.
That's great.
Yeah.
Now, were you surprised? I mean, these chefs are so incredibly insightful and articulate in this.
Oh, well, you know what? They are so interesting, and they had such different stories. I mean, there were stories about immigrants coming here. I mean, someone like Lydia Bastianich, who, you know, is so homey and wonderful and articulate and smart, and she was literally a refugee from Yugoslavia and had to leave, you know, her grandmother and her father and fled to Italy, and Catholic Charities brought them over to New York City. And her first, this is so funny, her first taste of American food was at a Horn and Hardit automat, you know, where you would put in the nickels from those Doris Day movies, you know, and pop out a piece of
pie.
She
thought that was wonderful. She'd never seen anything like
that. And I think that's when she was convinced that she had to bring some Italian cooking to America.
I can imagine. Here's a question for you. There are 27 chefs altogether. Did you actually do more than 27?
No. No. And in fact, there were so many more that we wanted to do, but being PBS, we don't have a lot of money. And so all of those shows were taped in a 3-week period. And so some of the chefs, like Mario Batali and Emeril Lagasse and Wolfgang Puck, had conflicts, and so they couldn't do our show. And I have since seen them, and they've said, why didn't I get on your show? And I said, well, your people told my people.
Well, how did you interview them? I mean, how did you get all this information out of them? What did you ask them?
Well, you know, I spent about 3 months really deep diving, doing a lot of research on who they were as people. And I tried to find out what made them tick. Because to this day, every single one of them are different. And for example, Jean-Georges Van Gerichten is one of the top chefs here in New York City, 4 stars from the New York Times, arguably one of the top chefs in America. And he came from Alsace, and he he opens restaurants, and he's there for about 2 years, and then he opens another restaurant. Mm-hmm. And now he has, I don't know how many restaurants, but he has over 3,000 employees around the world. He has restaurants in Shanghai, he has restaurants in Paris, and he's able to do them at a very top level. And so I was like, Jean George, you're so young. How did you learn to open these restaurants? And I found out that he was never a chef to stay in one restaurant. He worked for a great right. French chef in France who had consulting jobs all over the world. So what he really learned to do was to open restaurants. So uh-huh. when he came into his own, that's what he does. He opens restaurants. And someone like Charlie Palmer, the all-American boy from upstate New York,
right.
He was a football player. He looks like a football player. He's huge. And, you know, how does a guy like that start cooking? And it's a funny story that the home economics teacher in his high school lived next door, and she needed more people in her class. So she said to him, look, if you would come and take my class, I won't make you do any of the sewing or the crafts, and I'll just let you cook, and you can eat everything you want. And being a young football player, he was starving all the time. But he also didn't want the stigma of being the only boy in the home economics class. So he got most of the football team to take the class with him.
That must have been,
they all came with these fabulous, just fabulous stories.
Oh, I think this book I'd recommend.
They're caught
anyone.
In the book very well. Patrick Koo is my co-editor for that, and I think he just did a fabulous job.
Now, what about the photographer? Because the other thing is these photographs are so perfect. I'm sitting here looking at Patrick O'Connor with the rooster and the eggs. I guess it's the hen and eggs.
Right. Well, Patrick O'Connell, he did caviar with scrambled eggs, and it was just delicious. But the photographer is a very talented guy named Matthew Septimus, and I call him the court photographer for the French Culinary Institute. He started working with us, about 10 years ago, and almost all our photographs are done by him. And he has just an extraordinary style that's incredibly simple, but I think truly captures the essence of who the person is or what the technique is, or even if it's a still life. He really captures the soul of his subject.
Like Todd English with the lobster draped over his shoulder.
I know.
Isn't that perfect?
And that was all Matthew's idea. We had not styled that. And, people started arriving, and their cooking segment had to do with something they loved, an ingredient they loved or a technique they loved. And so Matthew got the idea of doing a portrait with the chef and the thing they loved. Dan Barber has a side of Berkshire pork, and Todd English has the lobster, and, Jacques Pepin has potatoes. Or no, that was Alain Seyac had potatoes. And
Tony Bourdain.
It is great. They are great portraits in there.
Oh, I just think
Tony Bourdain has a nasty bit.
Yes, he does. He does. He was a nasty. He was actually very sweet. People said to me, God, he looks so scared of you.
He looks scared of you. Amazing, yeah.
Yeah, he was a great fun. He told a very intellectual sort of story that, I think he is one of the most talented writers about food today. It transcends his TV. It transcends his, chefing. He is just such an insightful writer. And so I started asking him about writing, and he made a comment about this book Heat by Bill Buford. Do you know this book?
Yes,
Buford is a New Yorker writer and very talented. And he said, he said that book is a great example because Buford starts out as a writer, a New Yorker writer, and he ends up as a food writer. And I said, what makes that different? Yeah. And he said, just the verbs he uses in talking about food. Uh-huh. He says it subtly changes over the course of the book. And in the beginning, he's talking like an outsider observing. And at the end, he becomes a real food person because he's using the internal words. So everybody has to go out and get Heat and see what Tony means.
Oh, yeah. That's on the website, too. Go to the website, listeners, and do Chef Story. The website is onthemenuradio.com. Go to Bookshelf and scroll down and find Chef Story.
There you go.
Yes, and it's worth it.
You can be even smarter if you go to Internet Explorer, edit, find on this page, and type in a chef's story, and it'll take you right there.
Yeah, I mean, they're all the biggies on here. I mean, there are some missing, as you said, that you couldn't fit it into their schedule. But they're just fascinating. I liked the Norman Van Aken story, too.
Liked all of them. You know, I think he's one of the more undersung chefs that we have. But he's the one who coined the phrase New World Cuisine.
Yeah, I know.
And I think he's so emblematic of that new generation of chefs, American chefs, who said, look, I don't have to do what they're doing in France or anywhere in Europe. I'm just going to look right out my door here and say, what are the products here? What are the flavors here? And how can I take my training and make them the most delicious dishes possible? And that's what he did. I mean, if you have a chance to be in Miami, to go to Norman's restaurant, you will not be disappointed.
We were in that for 2 years ago, I guess. We were in New York for the Beards, and we went to Telepans. And they were making a fuss over us, you know, because of the radio show and everything. But we struck up a conversation with a couple sitting next to us. It turned out it was
Norman Van Aken and his wife.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And his wife, Janet, sweet.
And of course, he didn't make any to-do about anything, so Bill didn't even know he was in the restaurant. You know? I thought that was funny.
Charlie Trotter from Chicago worked for Norman. Norman was one of his mentors.
Really?
Yeah.
That's unusual.
Story about the guys, how they got into cooking, Norman Van Aken's is one of the wildest stories of all.
True. I think he was a hippie and a roofer. Slinging hamburgers, and then, you know, when some guy said to him, can't you read a book? I mean, he knew he couldn't afford to go to cooking school. A light bulb went on, and the passion bit him. But, he had a great story about how to get into cooking. And, you know, I love the Europeans, you know, André Soltner, and they tell stories about food deprivation during World War II.
Oh, right.
And you know, poor André Soltner, all they had were onions. Here's a growing boy. All they ate at night were onions, and his mother would coax a little juice out of an onion and put some flour with it and brown it and make it a gravy. And that's what they would eat for dinner, onions.
I mean, amazing.
And you can imagine that he had this temple of gastronomy in New York for all those years. And, the fire in their belly for what they did and do is just tremendous.
And Dorothy, I also want to talk to you about something else, but we need to take a break. Could you stay on the line while we take a break for ads?
Sure.
And talk about the new Italian Culinary Academy?
Oh, I'd love to. Thanks.
Okay. We'll take a break.
The flagship station of the Lifestyle Talk Radio Network. This is 1550 WLFP, Pittsburgh.
Hi, friends. I'm Phil Marcus, the host of Real Estate 101, heard every Saturday here on The Edge, AM 1550. If you've been thinking about selling your house or buying a house, I'd like to speak with you. Choosing the right agent is one of the first and most important steps in the process of buying or selling real estate. It's critical that you choose an agent who has the knowledge and experience to not only find that perfect new home for you, but to also be able to guide you step by step through the often complicated real estate process. If you don't already have a realtor, may I offer my services? I've been a real estate agent in Pittsburgh for almost 30 years. I'm a life member of the Realtors Association, and I'm proud to say that I've earned both the GRI and the coveted CRS professional designations. Won't you call me at RE/MAX Heritage? The phone number is 412-241-4200, extension 154, or my email address is phil@philmarcus.com. That's 412-241-4200, extension 154, or phil@philmarcus.com. Let's talk.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig.
Bet that music made you sit up.
It certainly did. It was a little loud there.
I think we might have our studio volume turned up a little loud.
And we're talking to Dorothy Hamilton, who's the founder and president of the French Culinary Institute. And we were talking to her about her book. She also hosted this fabulous series of Chef Story on public television. We have many interesting stories about that.
That's not enough. I mean, why would producing a book and creating a television series be enough to do? Dorothy
She's
Hamilton.
She's not much of a slacker. I've known her for a while.
Dorothy Hamilton has a part-time job heading the French Culinary Institute and decided that wasn't enough. So tell us about the next adventure.
So tell us about the new Italian Culinary Academy.
Well, you know, the way I started the French Culinary Institute 23 years ago was I went to Paris and I fell in love with this phenomenal school, the Official Cooking School of Paris, and we brought it to New York. And we train people exactly the same way they get trained in Paris in the fundamental techniques. Highly successful, 23 years, you know, in 6 months we take people who know nothing and we put them in the top kitchens in America. Well, you know, these Italian people came to visit in New York from Parma, Italy, which is the European capital of food now, and for the European, for the EC. And so they were looking to have a partnership with a school, and so they gave me a business class ticket to go to Italy for a week. And I thought,
wow,
they're serious, a business class ticket. So I and the head chef here got on a plane, and we went over there, and I was so taken with the school. It's in a 17th century or 18th century palazzo. It's been gutted and has state-of-the-art kitchens in it.
Oh, fabulous.
Formal gardens outside, and it's in a little town outside of Parma. And the food, when I sat down, was just sensational. I said, these are students cooking? And I couldn't get over it. So I came back here, and they didn't want to take amateurs. They wanted seasoned professionals that knew about Italian cuisine. So we created a new program called the Italian Culinary Academy. It's a whole school to its own self. It's in the same building with FCI, but it's its own school. It has its own dedicated kitchens that are specially designed for Italian cooking. And students come here and do the first 10 weeks in New York, so they get every fundamental of Italian cooking and an exposure to all the different regions and regional cooking. And then they fly over to Parma and they spend another 9 weeks in school over there. And then they do a stage in Italian restaurants, or they can come back to the States and do a stage. And I was talking through the break with you that I was a Peace Corps volunteer and very early in my life, and I have a great prejudice that I think if you're going to go to a foreign country, you should at least try to speak some of the language. And so we've put a very special component, very unique component, into this Italian cooking class that you get total immersion Italian language as you're doing it.
Oh, that's
so
perfect.
When you come to New York, not only will you be studying Italian cooking, but this particular group will be studying total immersion Italian as well. So when they go over there, they, you know, this isn't like studying language in high school where you're going to get tests on grammar. This is all about knowing how to speak and saying how much does that cost and where is the train station and, you know, phrases like that. So you're functioning just like a Peace Corps volunteer does in countries.
Dorothy, these are U.S. students?
Some are U.S. students and some are foreign students.
Okay.
We have, you know, 10% of the students, you know, we have 2,000 students a year, and 10% are from all over the world.
Okay.
And in fact, about 18 months ago, France 2 Television, which is the NBC of France, came here and did a documentary, and they called us the most prestigious cooking school in the world.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And now we have 5 students from France who've come to New York to study French cooking in English.
That's amazing.
And we have students from Saigon and, you know, French-speaking students from around the world, but we do teach in English. We have a lot of students from Brazil, Korea, Israel. We have a former Miss Guatemala studying here.
Really?
Yeah, it's a very fascinating, it's a fun place to come and study because we have a restaurant downstairs. And, you know, one day I was eating with Morimoto, this is about a month ago, and Mario Batali walks in with Cesare Casella.
It's my goodness.
It's, you know, it's kind of a hangout for all the foodies in New York.
That's good. How about a website?
Well, you can go to www.frenchculinary.com. That gets you into the French Culinary Institute, or www.italianculinaryacademy.com. Or you can go to just the internationalculinarycenter.com,
which is the
and
new name
that would get
for,
you into all the schools.
Yeah, that's the new name for this whole ensemble.
Right. And if you didn't catch those .coms, just Google us. You know, we're based in New York City.
Now, didn't you also do a program with some chefs from Spain, too?
Oh, you know, last year when we were opening, we doubled in size, and so the buildings become the International Culinary Center. And the Spanish government worked with us, and we brought over the 10 top chefs of Spain, including Ferran Adrià, who is that genius in north of Barcelona, sure, doing a lot of this new avant-garde food. And Juan Maria Zac from San Sebastian, right, and we just had this three-day extravaganza here of an interaction with chefs and the public, and then chefs to chefs, sharing ideas and sharing philosophies. It was incredibly exciting.
It's sort of like our version of Madrid Fusion.
Now next,
right, exactly.
Now, next time you start bringing over Spanish chefs, don't forget the only woman chef with three Michelin stars in Spain.
Oh, she's fabulous. Do you know her?
Her name is...
Elena Arzac?
No.
Her name is Carmen Ruscalleda.
Oh, no, I don't know her.
And,
she's South...
She and her husband own a restaurant. It's about 50 kilometers north of Barcelona, on the way to Roses, where Ferranadra is at. And she's absolutely
fabulous.
Terrific.
She had the Japanese invited her to open in Tokyo.
Oh,
and she did, and she's petite. You know, these women chefs are often very petite, and mm-hmm, it just seemed a brave thing from this little countryside space for her to be flying to Japan. They gave her a work of art to create a dish around, as you know, as an introduction.
Wow.
Yeah, she's
probably
also an artist.
They probably gave her a free business class ticket too, though.
Yes, right, and that's a longer trip.
It's a long trip.
Maybe they gave her a first class ticket.
Yeah, probably true.
Now, you said that this new Italian Culinary Academy, you said, was sort of a reflection of how the world is going. You said that during...
Well, you know, the most restaurants in the United States are Italian. If you take any one ethnic, including American as an ethnic, the quantitative most restaurants are Italian. And there are so many people that really want to learn the techniques, and they are different. Italian cuisine is so ingredient-based and then regionally based. And so what we've done is put together a program where we highlight 10 of the regions in Italy, and we bring in different kinds of chefs from all these different regions. So the students aren't wedded to just the Parma, Emilia-Romagna cuisine. Mm-hmm. And they get a chance to go around. There's a lot of field trips there. But if you can't take the time to go to Italy, we also have other courses here in the Italian Culinary Academy that you could do right here in New York. So,
have you experienced any of the choice of words, experimental cuisine, the influence of Ferranadria in Italy?
Oh, sure. You know, Wiley Dufresne at WD50 here in New York is one of the biggest practitioners of that.
Oh, wait.
He's a graduate of FCI.
Yeah, I just wrote a piece about him, profiling him. His grandmother lives in Pittsburgh.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
So, but anyhow, I meant in Italy, because that's something that a lot of people don't know about.
Oh,
when they,
well,
they
Ayamo is Ayamo's cuisine. He's south of Rome, and he actually, I didn't experience it there, but he came here and he was doing some
of
it.
I don't know that one.
This is, well, the people we know best, the last name is Alamjo, or Alanjo, Alanjo, and they're just outside Padua.
Padua.
Oh. No, I don't know that.
Then,
there's so many great chefs around.
Three Michelin stars.
And then there's another guy called Massimo, I forget his last name, who's in Modena.
Oh.
He was very smart. He married one of the descendants of the Eastman family from Rochester.
Really?
Yeah.
So one of these days he's going to have a restaurant in New York, and I think probably if he feels like having one, he'll probably have one.
Yeah. Yes, I think so. Well, it's always good to, you know, if you want to make a small fortune, start with a large one.
That's a good rule of thumb.
If you're heading over to Parma anytime soon, both Modena and
Padua are not that far.
Are quite close by.
Yes. Well, I have to. It seems like you do a lot of traveling yourselves, huh?
That's how you qualify to be on this program. You don't have to be very good, but you have to know something.
Well, do you have a favorite cuisine?
All of them. It moves. We were very French last week because we were at Danielle, and we were very modern American 2 days before that because we were at Gilt.
Oh,
he's doing a great job.
So it's now the mood of the moment is maybe the last great meal we ate.
Yeah, I mean, that happens. Yeah.
That's true. I mean, what did James Beard say when they said, what's your favorite restaurant? And he said, the one where they make me feel at home, that they know me.
Oh, yeah.
Make me feel like an owner.
Because he was a genuine character. Did you ever? We actually met a flight attendant who used to be on the Concorde, and she remembered serving James Beard. And I don't know if you know this, but he used to buy two seats.
I can understand why. And the Concorde had small seats, so he was a rather large man.
Right.
Actually, I was. My breath was taken away. I was introduced to him, and I met him. Julia Child was my mentor, and she was. I always called her my fairy godmother. She took a special interest in me and the school, and it was very early on. I opened the school in '84, and so this I think was in 1984. And she said, "Dorothy, you have to come to the Four Seasons restaurant. We're having a do there." And so it was like 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and I went over there, and it was a private room upstairs above the pool room, and I went in there, and it was all the heavies in the New York food world back then, and Jacques Pepin, this is Dorothy Cam, and, you know, she introduced me, and then she says, come over here, and she walked me over, and there's James Beard sitting there like an emperor, and my breath was taken away, and I was going to go up and say, Mr. Beard, what an honor to meet you, and before I could say anything, Julia said, Jim, here's Dorothy Cann I was telling you about. And he put his hand out, and he goes, I've been so looking forward to meeting you. And he shook my hand. And that just floored me. I just couldn't believe that those were the words James Beard said to me.
Funny.
Meeting me. He couldn't wait to meet me. I was just overwhelmed by meeting him. He was a very generous and wonderful man, you know, and I know he helped a lot of young cooks and people like myself in New York in those days.
Dorothy, we could talk forever. I'm getting signals from the director that we have to wrap this segment up. So
okay.
I just wanted to thank you for calling in and enjoyed it. And anytime you want to talk about anything, just give us a buzz.
Okay. Will do.
And
all
I
right.
loved
well, thank
it.
You so much.
And look forward to seeing you soon.
Yes, please stop by.
I will.
Okay. All
thanks,
right.
Thanks, Dorothy.
Bye-bye.
Ciao.
Ciao.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Join us for the Apollo Moon Landing Celebration July 17th through the 21st, Apollo PA. 5 great days of family fun, featuring the award-winning Katanning Fireman's Band, games and rides for the kids, nightly entertainment, food. It's just good old summer fun. The Apollo Moon Landing Celebration, July 17th through the 21st at Owens Field in Apollo.
Roger. We copy you down, Eagle.
Listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and we're going to take a little jaunt back down to Charleston.
Yeah, we're
going to
do something. First track up is something a little bit different. One of the toughest jobs in the world has to be being the general manager of a luxury hotel. Joe Kane of the Pittsburgh Hilton and various other restaurants here in Pittsburgh became a legend because he was so effective at doing that. And at the Charleston Place Hotel in Charleston, we met General Manager Paul, who's going to tell us a little bit about what his experience there has been like.
The city of Charleston in Spoleto, semi-madness, because the city grows larger than any other time of the year, and there's lots of things going on. And in the middle of it is an oasis of charm, a serene lodging establishment called the Charleston Place Hotel. And we're very fortunate to have the opportunity to catch the General Manager, Paul Stracey, who's so much in control of the situation, he can sit here and join us for an interview. Paul, first of all, welcome. As I was saying to you just a moment ago, here's further evidence that the British are reconquering the world. Tell us about what Charleston Place is like from the eye of the general manager who's running the whole place.
Well, I've been here for almost 12 years now, and I have to tell you, it's home for me. The employees and the people I work with, the other division managers and department heads and what have you, are all really like a great big family. It's a pleasure to come to work every day. So for me, it's money for old rope. I love working here. It's been a great, great experience. We try to showcase a hotel that is authentic in its design and fits in well with Charleston. If you look around the property, you'll see all sorts of pointers to the downtown area, the big mansions that are on the Battery. And you'll see that it is a beautiful Southern Belle gem. However, we try to make it a fun hotel as well. A lot of grand hotels can be a little bit stuffy sometimes, a little bit stiff. We try to be a little bit more relaxed. Charleston itself is a very relaxed destination. And you'll see that, for instance, in our Charleston Grill, we have live jazz, which is not normal in a fine dining, wonderful, wonderful restaurant. So we do try to have a little bit more fun than perhaps your standard luxury hotel.
Now, it is a new building, though. It's not a restoration of an old building. I'm right in thinking that it was custom-built for this purpose?
That's right. It was built about 20 years ago and was the brainchild of our current mayor, who's been mayor for many, many terms, and he's a wonderful, wonderful man and does a great thing for Charleston. And he wanted it to bring back downtown Charleston. At that stage, Charleston's downtown needed some revitalization. And after much planning, design, questioning, and preservation societies getting involved to make sure it didn't be too overbearing downtown, they built this structure, and it has indeed brought back downtown. It started life as an Omni, and we came as an Orient Express in 95 and took it over from an Omni and have very slowly, because it always was a great hotel. Omni did a fantastic job. And we took over and have basically now renovated absolutely everything over the 10 years. And it's become, you know, the next level of hotel now. Downtown Charleston needed it, and it's here.
And it's right in the middle, isn't it? It's next to the market section for those people who are interested in that kind of shopping. It's right next to King Street. So there's magnificent shopping there, including dozens and dozens of shoe stores that are dangerous to Anne and Peter's pocket when we come here. So it's right in the center. And at the center of the hotel is this serene oasis of calm called the Club.
That's right. We are certainly in the center of everything. And you have within walking distance, 10 minutes access to absolutely everything you could possibly want to do in Charleston. The, as you say, the oasis of the hotel is up the 7th and 8th floors, which are the club floors, and or concierge floors, as some hotels call them. And we offer a very special service up there. We have dedicated concierges up there, dedicated staff just for those 80 rooms that are on those two floors. And we offer full refreshments, a great breakfast, wonderful afternoon tea, cocktails, hors d'oeuvres, pretty much a full lineup of food presentations all throughout the day. And people love it. It sells out very often more than our regular rooms. And actually, you'll see people time and time and time again that know the names of the employees up there and actually come looking for Frank the bartender, for instance.
Okay, so a website then for people to be able to get more information and to be able to make reservations?
CharlestonPlace.com.
Thank you so much for talking to us, Paul. And it's been a delight for us to stay here. We've been delighted to be your guest, and listeners, you should be delighted to be a guest here too.
I certainly am. It's a wonderful place. And while I can, I'd love to thank all the great associates I work with that make working here a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, I mean, I'm happy to go there and stay anytime.
The British are coming, you notice.
Yeah.
You notice who's in charge, listeners.
The next one up is not British.
The next one is not British. The next one is interesting. You would not think of a restaurant named Fig as standing for food is good, but indeed it is. And we interviewed the chef owner of this restaurant before it even opened for the day. We popped in at lunchtime because somebody absolutely insisted that this is a man we needed to talk to in Charleston, so we did.
We've moved on the menu has, to a wonderful restaurant that we previously had to miss out for some reason, and it's called Fig, which stands for Food is Good, and this pâté we're nibbling on certainly is. We're talking to Mike Latta, who is the chef, co-owner of this restaurant. Hi, Mike.
How are you?
This pâté is really delicious. I might say. Your background, just to summarize it, you're a Massachusetts boy who ended up cooking around in the South and then cooking your way through France and Italy. And then you got this call to come to Charleston and set up this restaurant, primarily because of your involvement with local farmers and premier ingredients. Is that true?
Yes. Fig was born from the idea of capitalizing, utilizing all the local products that was available in Charleston. So in over the years that I'd been here, we've developed relationships with a lot of local growers and really felt as though we wanted to have a true expression of what Charleston in the Lowcountry has to offer today. So we've collected all of our peers and our growers to bring together a menu that's distinctively Lowcountry today in Charleston.
Now, I think I just skimmed over your background. If there's anything in particular about your background you'd like to elaborate on, please do.
I think the best way to talk about my background is that I'm a self-taught chef, no culinary school. Decided after about a year and a half of college to be a broadcast journalist, actually, that I wanted to pursue being a chef. I'd cooked all through high school and through college, and I'd always loved it and felt very comfortable doing it. And once, after my first semester, my first year of college at Northeastern in Boston, I decided that it probably wasn't for me, actually. Well, if you've got a second, the story is, really, I took a semester off, went back to UMass Amherst, and after a week of going to school at UMass Amherst, I had a terrible, terrible class that I couldn't stomach, and it was called Introductory to Logic. And on the bus, I lived about 10 miles away from campus, on the bus to school one day, I saw that Julia Child was speaking on my campus, at the same time my class was. So instead of going to my 10:30 Introductory to Logic class, I went to see Julia Child speak at one of the halls on campus. She captivated an audience for what seemed like 2 or 3 hours. It was amazing. 300 people, standing room only. She had everybody just, on the edge of their seats with all these great stories and inspirations. After I left that class, that was the last class I went to in college, and decided that I needed to move back to Boston and pursue my career as a chef.
That's a good story. Now, I also didn't mention that Fig was, and congratulations, a finalist for Best Chef Southeast. Congratulations to you.
Thank you. That came as a nice surprise. I got a phone call early in the morning, the day the nominees were announced, and we were truly honored to be nominated.
It's a very casual restaurant, which is your intention. Casual fine dining is the current term. You said that you are ingredient focused, and also that you have influences from rustic French and country Italian. That's basically the dynamic, isn't it?
It is. I think that our concept here on the East Coast is not unlike what you might see in California. I've eaten in San Francisco and a few places outside of San Francisco, and it seems there's a very close tie. There is a very close tie to what's being grown locally and what's being cooked. And how the food is prepared reflects the respect for the ingredients. And I think that food on the East Coast is cooked a little bit differently for reasons that we don't have a lot of the same, we don't have an abundance of growers, and it's very difficult here in Charleston because the real estate's such a premium that we don't have a lot of growers. So I guess what I'm saying is the concept mimics that, I think, of California cuisine in spirit, going back to also, the French, and country French and rustic Italian aspect of it. It's simple, it's honest, it's straightforward. But we do spend a lot of time, a lot of our efforts are spent on knowing our growers, knowing where the food comes from, knowing how it was treated, and hopefully respecting that so the customer can appreciate the integrity of the ingredient.
Mike, I would like to have you explain your philosophy of well-executed ingredient, local ingredient-directed cuisine, using as an example this wonderful chicken pate that you presented us.
Well, I guess the idea behind us finding the best ingredients, we want to showcase those ingredients as naturally as we can without mucking up the plate, so to speak, and putting too many things in the plate, which take away from the actual execution in many ways from the final product. So what we try to do is keep things as simple as possible and focus on execution so you can understand and taste how special these ingredients are that are from our local farmers. And with the pâté in particular, we use a recipe that I learned a long time ago, which is an emulsion of chicken livers and fat back, pork fat back. So we procure our livers locally, and we also get the fat back from a local pig farmer between here and Columbia, South Carolina. And the end result is a super creamy, super luscious pâté that has become a signature item here at Fig and probably will be here for a long time to come.
Well, again, thank you for welcoming us, and can't wait to come back and revisit.
Thank you for stopping by.
Could you tell us one time about how to give a website?
We do. It's www.eatatfig.com.
Well, with that, I'm sure, listeners, you'll be able to find your way to this great little restaurant. Well, we've had a full house today.
Didn't we just?
Didn't we just?
If only listeners knew what went on behind the scenes today. But it's our little secret. And we'll see you same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.
Jazzin' Around with David J. is next on The Edge, AM 1550.